You are listening to Kubernetes Bytes, a podcast bringing you the latest from the world of cloud-native data management. My name is Ryan Wallner, and I'm joined by Bhavin Shah, coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. We'll be sharing our thoughts on recent cloud-native news and talking to industry experts about their experiences and challenges managing the wealth of data in today's cloud-native ecosystem. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. We're coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. Today is July 5th, 2023. Hope you're doing well and staying safe. Let's dive into it. July 5th, Bhavin, I hope you enjoyed your 4th. Tell me what's good. Hopefully you have a good time.
Yeah, it was fun and all, I guess. But Boston didn't get the memo that it's not supposed to rain on the 4th. People are supposed to be outside, have barbecue. And yeah, it was raining for, I think, 3/4 of the day. I didn't make it to the fireworks show at 10:30 p.m. last night. But saw videos this morning and they didn't look good. Like, there was so much fog in the sky. Like, you could barely see the fireworks. It was just some random dim
like lightning lights in the distance at that point.
Yeah, it was not fun. But like, again, I scrolled through a lot of Instagram, right? So there was the traditional reading of the declaration from the old state house and the parade with everybody dressed up as patriots and things like that. Again, didn't see that in person. But it was there. I guess I had a good 4th of July long weekend for myself. Just helped out a few friends who were moving. Caught up on some chores and then just took a day off. That's it.
Oh, yeah. How about you, Ryan? Moving this weekend? Oh, you're a good friend, but you know, it's always a pain.
Yeah, it was. Like, I think it took us 5 or 6 hours. And then we were so tired by the end of it. Like, everybody just wanted to skip, like, even a beer that we were supposed to have after. Like,
I was going to say, hopefully they paid you in food or libations.
Yeah, they did. Right? Yeah, but not worth it, dude. Like, just hire movers. You know?
Just hire movers. You're like, you ask your friend, and Bobbin's like, how about I just pay some movers for you? And we can hang out instead. That's good.
Yeah. How about you, Ryan? How was your food?
It was good. I spent some time with my father and daughter over the weekend, which it was actually a lot nicer then. Sunday was a bit rainy, but you know, all things considered, I drove to New York on the 4th actually to hang out with some family, and it was much nicer there. So I didn't get caught in the rain other than driving through it a bit. So okay. I can't complain too much. Although it's funny now that you mention it, at the 11 plus years I've been in this area, I've never been to like the festivities in Boston on July 4th. I think mostly because huge events in major cities, I'm just like, I don't know, just like too many people, you know. I love Boston, like I really do, and I just go on like the downtime, and I have a lot of time. But hey,
for me, it's just like I will have to go find parking, maybe walk a couple of miles just to get to the thing. Like,
I don't even bother driving. I mean, now that the Sumner Tunnel's closed, I think tonight, right?
Yeah.
I'm just planning my airport trips now. Like,
yeah. If you fly before I do, like, just let me know how much time it takes. I'm thinking I'll take a detour through Everett. Maybe, hopefully that gets me there sooner. But yeah, I'm not looking forward to traveling the next 2 months. And I have like a work trip and a personal trip during that time. So
yeah, it's going to be interesting and not in a fun way. So you just go in and just think of the worst case scenario. That way it only gets better from there, right?
Good
way to set yourself up.
Set your expectation like really low.
Really low. As low as it can go. Like, you're going to get stuck, and then like your driver's going to get a ticket, and you like walk down the wrong road. Like, just start there.
Yeah.
And then figure it out.
Nice.
All right. So we have a cool episode today. Before we jump in there and introduce our guest, let's dive into some news. Why don't you kick us off?
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you. With professional-grade industrial supplies, count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy 2, get 2 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah. So talking about news, as we saw in the last episode, right? Again, another couple of slow weeks for us in at least the cloud native ecosystem. But just a few things that I wanted to highlight. Aqua Security released their cybersecurity report for 2023. And they had a few good insights that spoke about, like, the first one being they saw an increase of software supply chain attacks. Again, we all know what those are, but the attacks grew more than 300% year over year. So obviously that's becoming
Quite a bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Hot topic. And it's the layers, right? Like the different layers that with the microservices architecture or with the cloud native stack, we have so many layers in the application tier or in the infrastructure layer. That's proving challenging to secure, and it's interdependency between different components makes it really appealing to attackers. So even if you miss that one spot, like all you need is the weakest link in the chain and you can break through. So software supply chain attacks was like the number one thing. They also have a list of the top 10 vulnerabilities from 2022. So if you were not in the same organization 2022, maybe take a look at those. Maybe make sure your organization has fixed those CVEs and are not exposed.
Or considering them, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, all those 10 were focused around remote, the ability to do remote code execution into your environment. So like once they get in, they run some code, and which is not good. And I think one of the key things that I found interesting was 50% of the attacks in this year's reports focused on defense evasion. So like even the hackers and the attackers are getting smarter. They know what the typical defense systems are and how they get recognized by these security tools. So they have found ways to go around it and make sure that they're not detected even if they get in.
Learning from the techniques that we have in place to secure ourselves, sounds like AI now is producing and learning from it. I can't say I'm surprised, though, given how much this market has grown. Like, we're going to see an uptick in how people try to exploit it. I can't say enough about trying to get that, you know, get security mindset first early on.
Yeah, like we linked to the blog and the report that they published, so please read through it.
We'll link to a couple of the previous episodes on security too. Yeah. I think there's a lot of good nuggets in there too.
Perfect. And talking about AI, right? Like a new company called Causely, they call themselves a casual AI company. They raised $8.6 million in their seed funding. They are building a platform that automates end-to-end detection, prevention, remediation of critical defects. This is a line from their website. So it looks like a marketing line. They do have a module, which they call Causely for Kubernetes applications.
Okay.
It's now in early access. So again, if you want to try it out, you can. I'm not sure. Like, again, it's just seed round, right? Like, so they're just getting started, finding that product market fit. But at least the co-founders look like they are serial entrepreneurs in our ecosystem. Have started, founded companies and sold them to AWS and IBM and those guys. So something to keep an eye out for. Whatever with the term AI pops up, I make sure that we include it on our show notes and talk about those funding rounds. And then in addition to these two, not really news, but just links that I wanted to share with our listeners. The PlatformCon event that happened maybe last month has all of their sessions now posted on YouTube. So if you didn't, if you weren't able to attend the live sessions, which I wasn't, you can go and catch up on recordings. And then over the 4th of July weekend, I guess Kelsey Hightower decided to do a Twitter space where he talked about what Kubernetes did to him. And if you follow him on Twitter, you'll see a few interesting tweets over the last couple of days. So I am, I think, 40 minutes into the 2-hour Twitter space. So I'm listening to it, but I just wanted to share it with our listeners as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Some good nuggets there. Some interesting nuggets. I guess we could probably bring them up on a totally different show. Maybe just do an episode on exactly what he's talking about or something.
Like that would be fun. Maybe get him on.
There we go. That'd be great too.
No, that's it for news for me, Ryan. Over to you.
Absolutely. So just a couple for me. The one was Portainer.io. They announced K2D.io, which is basically a K3S alternative, so to speak.
Okay.
It's a lightweight Kubernetes distribution kind of targeted at, you know, low computing power environments, IoT, those kind of things. But, you know, there's another option out there besides K3S. I know you know, those types of distributions have been, you know, in the uptick as we move things to the edge and all that. So really interesting stuff. The article on here kind of talks about sort of their own testing and what machines they put it on, how much memory and all that stuff. So if you're into that, go check it out.
While you were talking about it, right, I was curious, like, why are they calling it K2D? Like, we know the K8S, like, we know what it means. Like, what is K2D? Like, if they wanted to use four-letter word, why just make it a three-letter word and add that too? And it's actually Kubernetes to Docker. It's not a word. So that's my only participation or comment on your news.
It's in the article. It says K2D is not Kubernetes. It says it's an API translator.
Yeah.
So alternative to K3S, but yes, not Kubernetes. It's a different type of way of doing things. But yeah, absolutely. Good point. The next one I have is from the SUSE folks over at SUSE, Elemental Cloud Native OS Management in Kubernetes. Basically, Elemental is a toolkit and aims at delivering minimal enterprise Linux and with OCI and all that kind of stuff. So if you're kind of looking at or probably using Rancher or something like that, maybe something to go check it out. Anyway, I thought it was pretty cool. Also, fan of the, you know, Elemental name, I guess. I like that. little rings true. The other one is, I don't know if this is old news or new news, Mission Control Self-Managed from VMware Tanzu. It was an announcement blog, but I basically taking the Mission Control SaaS deployments of, you know, managing Tanzu and everything and doing it in a way that we can deploy it on-prem or in sort of sovereign kind of deployments and getting the same sort of experience that you got out of the Mission Control SaaS on-prem. So interesting stuff there. Definitely. I think is telling to maybe, you know, how companies are definitely looking at where people are running their Kubernetes. So whether it's on-prem or in the cloud or you know, giving them options. So,
And I agree, right? Like it's not a new thing. Like I think I went to the last VMware Explore last year. They announced it in early access or private beta.
But it's available I did register now, for it.
Okay. Yeah. It's now generally available. I think you can, if you have a VMware.com account, you can download those binaries and deploy it.
Yeah. Cool. So if you're a VMware shop, maybe that's for you.
Yeah.
And then the last one, which I did talk about with some coworkers last week, which was NetApp. They launched SpotOcean CD, basically Kubernetes delivery on top of their Spot kind of delivery already. So kind of taking advantage of how you know CD plays into the process of how the advantages of Spot and Ocean and all those things kind of tied together. So if you're already using that kind of thing or interested in what Spot is and you're kind of in the Kubernetes game and doing continuous delivery, definitely go take a look at the stuff and kind of dig into it. I think it's a quite interesting. I've always been really interested in the Spot technology. I think it's a really great one.
Yeah.
There's not a ton that like, you know, compares directly. So to build something on top of that, I think I like that. Extensibility to how they're using it and how NetApp's doing that. So go take a look at that. And that's all I had.
Awesome.
Awesome. The last thing we do want to bring up here is it's a little bit of our own news.
Let's go.
We have added a Slack workspace. So that's kubernetesbytes.slack.com. Come, if you're a previous guest or listener, come check it out. We have places for you to introduce yourself, talk with us, suggest episodes. That's one place we want to definitely you know, really hear from you if you're you know, wanting to join our Slack workspace and have ideas that you want to get to us and want to really hear about something. Please go say hello and check it out. We also have a LinkedIn page now, so come you know, be friends with us professionally, I guess
you could say. No, I think I like the Slack idea, right? Like we have been talking about it for a while. It just helps bring the community together. Like we have kept these episodes, I know more than 50 episodes as vendor neutral, so we're not there to sell anything. It's just we just decided to make it a place where listeners who are part of the CNCF community or the cloud native community can join in, talk to each other. Maybe they have challenges and maybe somebody else from the community has already solved them. So use that as a place to just collaborate, just get to know more people. I'm pretty sure we might end up creating a new Slack channel called Job Listings. So if you're looking for a job and if you are a vendor who's hiring, maybe we can use this Slack channel to like bring the two together.
Yes.
But yeah, again, it's brand new. We want to see how it evolves, how it grows. We'll have a make sure that We'll make sure that we have a code of conduct, I think. Like, be respectable to anyone who is on the Slack channel. But apart from that, yeah, feel free to join in. We'll put the link in the show notes, but it's just kubernetesbytes.slack.com. Join in and let's talk.
Absolutely. And we're excited to see you there. Speaking of excited, we do have a great guest, Surya Origanti. I'm hopefully saying that correctly. He's the founder of Argonaut. We're going to talk all about what Argonaut is and kind of the challenges that it's trying to solve in the community and kind of why he started to build this technology. Yeah. So without further ado, let's get Surya on. All right, Surya, welcome to Kubernetes Bytes. It's great to have you here. Why don't you introduce yourself and kind of give a brief overview of kind of who you are, what you do, and what's going on.
Thanks for having me. I'm Surya. I am the founder of Argonaut. Just a quick history. I started my career like over a decade ago at Microsoft. I was working on Bing ads. And I was working on like the pricing of ads and predicting the probability with which a user would click on an ad, all the creepy stuff. And then, but it was very cool work in the sense that it involved large scale optimization, a lot of pretty cool machine learning there. It was also a very fast-paced environment where, you know, we would have super large number of experiments that are going on with a very mature A-B testing framework, etc., like peak A-B testing, right?
Sure.
After that, I moved to a very different domain because I wanted to also move to a startup.
Mm-hmm.
And I was building a first-of-its-kind electric scooter. I was leading the software and connectivity hardware, like hardware efforts as well, like touchscreens and such. And then, the startup experience was really, really good, right? Worked with a lot of really smart people, and it was also a huge amount of ownership and responsibility. So I loved that, and I sort of went increasingly smaller in terms of the companies that I chose to work with. And I worked at a couple of enterprise AI startups after that in the retail and HR tech space.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I... you know, decided to start with a company of one, which is
the smallest of
yeah. Yeah. And currently I'm building Argonaut. Argonaut is an internal developer platform that helps you automate and manage infrastructure and app deployments to clouds like AWS and GCP.
Gotcha. That's an interesting background, right? Like going from Bing ads to electric scooters to AI in the human tech resource space. Wow, that's, and just doing that over a decade. So that's, I'm sure you had a lot of fun. I know you said Argonaut is that internal developer platform. Can you expand a bit more on that? Like, what does it do? How does it help?
Right. So our mission is to make software operations painless for engineering teams so that teams can generally focus more of their engineering efforts on building stuff that their users want, their customers actually pay them for, as opposed to just keeping the lights on, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, that's basically the core of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, specifically, given that Argonaut is an internal developer platform, and we aim to be like the one place that engineering teams can go to manage their app deployments and cloud infrastructure.
Sure.
Now, that's putting it very concisely, and that involves like a lot of different things, right? The way we go about it is we provide some intuitive abstractions and automation of software operations, mm-hmm. so that teams can generally get started very quickly and also, you know, not have to spend too much time configuring stuff and just trying to get things to work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we actually concretely look at the workflow that users have with and without Argonaut, like traditionally, companies have application deployment teams, which have their business logic and user-facing features and all of that. And then there is the the platform team, which actually enables these pieces of code to be deployed mm-hmm. in a secure, scalable manner with all the collaboration requirements and like compliance requirements, etc., taken into consideration. Right now, if we just break that down, that involves like a lot of steps, and each of those steps has its own sort of best of breed kind of solution that works for that particular stage. Mm-hmm. Right now, essentially the role that we play is that of an orchestrator, And we stitch all of these things together, all of these different steps and stages, so that, you know, anyone who's using the product can have a full understanding of what's going on.
Okay.
Now, yeah, so just tying that together, right? These steps that I'm referring to would look like provisioning cloud infrastructure, mm-hmm. using things like infrastructure as code, etc., picking runtimes, building code, generating artifacts, scanning and securely storing them, and then eventually deploying them. And then you have the day-to-day activities where you have observability and cost. So absolutely. All of these are things that we, you know, bring together, as opposed to teams having to build them in-house over a period of time.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I feel like we've heard a lot of, even from Detroit and even in Amsterdam, right? The complexities that I think the more layers we add on to Kubernetes and everything you need to actually have a fully fledged sort of working thing, it takes quite a lot of different skill sets. And this is something I think we're seeing more and more of. Now, what I'm curious is, you know, a bit of your origin story about why you decided to make a company of one, right? So was it your personal experience doing these exact things? Or did you also see, you know, other companies or maybe, you know, users or coworkers struggling through this process? And give me a little bit about that.
It's actually a bit of both, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you look at a team like Microsoft, you have a lot of people just working on this particular problem and making sure that people, like most of the application engineers, etc., don't even have to think about a lot of these problems, right? Mm-hmm. You just somehow magically it just works. and then there are like a million fairies sitting under the hood and just weaving their magic through.
Yep.
It's actually a fairly complex problem, right? And so that sort of gave me an exposure for like what a fairly seamless kind of process would look like. Mm-hmm. And then as I was working with startups, it increasingly fell to me to also build, you know, pretty much the entire stack out. That includes, like I was responsible for managing software and product teams over time, right? And, you know, it was always this very interesting trade-off where I would have like a lot of user-facing features, etc., that we would want to be delivering. And then we would be continuously bogged down by the inefficiencies, etc., that we see. And, you know, we internally had to build for.
Sure.
Now, that was great. Like, building that once was a great experience. And then turns out in pretty much every place that I was working with, the same thing had to be built from scratch. And also over the last few years, right, with the advent of Kubernetes and generally everyone starting off their journeys on the cloud, as opposed to, you know, a decade ago where it was closer to a decade ago where it was more of, you know, you manage your own hardware, etc. Given the shift, the shape of the solution also started looking similar. So essentially we had like underfunded teams and we had like a lot of things to deliver on.
Yep.
And the shape of the solution looked similar and we had to build this out from scratch at every single place. So this was a very inefficient mix, and that's sort of what led to you know, figuring out, hey, like, why don't we just do this, solve it as a product, and make it available for, you know, as small a team as possible, and then enable them to have the same kind of efficiency and rigor that, you know, larger organizations can afford.
Yeah.
And help them scale.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's really how it came around.
I forget who we talked to, Bob, and maybe you said this, but that we had an analogy about, you know, once you get big enough where you're like operating like a large kitchen, you know, everybody has sort of a different task and at hand. Yep. And that's the magic that happens that you kind of take for granted until you're at a smaller team and trying to do it all yourself, right? You have all those skill sets now that you must all, you know, do from scratch to finishing and plating and all those things. I thought that analogy was pretty good. But yeah, I feel like, you know, this is a really cool space to be in, and you know, exciting to see what Argonaut's up to.
And so Surya, right, like the problem that you identified definitely exists in the ecosystem today. Like startups especially who are starting with their journey need a tool so that they can spend time on delivering like business value and differentiation and actually work, make their beer taste better and not focus on actually delivering an infrastructure stack. But I want to also talk about the other perspective where larger enterprises, right? Not everybody can be a Microsoft, but since you have been at Microsoft, I'm sure there was not a, just a single IDP or a single platform. Each team, each business unit might have its own platform that, that they are using. And when I talk to customers on as part of my day job, again, everybody likes to talk about platform engineering and that one solution, but that's not true, right? You might have 10 different platforms, quote unquote, that you use to deliver developer services to your end users, which in case are developers. How does Argonaut fit this use case? How can it help bigger enterprises which already have these different teams and different organizations working on individual platforms?
Right. So a couple of different facets here. Mm-hmm. I'll preface this with the fact that, you know, we sort of deal with mid-market kind of customers and not too much enterprise-y at this point. And because of that, we've sort of avoided this problem for a little while. However, from there are a few things that we're putting together in place to ensure that we don't, like, when we run into these situations, we don't hit against a wall, right? Mm-hmm. Primarily, one of the core things that we do is try to make everything on industry standards. Yep. Industry standards as in some cases, there are no standards as such, at which point we, pick the most popular tool of choice for that particular problem and go with that, right? Now, this affords us a good standardizing layer, which means that things can flow in and out of the system, out of the Argonaut boundary very easily, right? Mm-hmm. Now, for instance, this could be things like the fact that, we use Argo CD to power our GitOps related deployments.
Yeah.
Right. There are like two players who are sort of the more popular ones in this space. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we picked the one which we thought was more flexible and was generally a little more broadly adopted.
Is this Flux and Argo, basically?
Yes. Flux and Argo. Right.
Okay.
That's one example. And then, when it comes to infrastructure as code, there are like a couple of different providers that that work. We've chosen Terraform because it's sort of the de facto.
Yep.
And pretty much everyone else is like has very unique propositions and they're very interesting. Mm-hmm. And we'll probably expand out to support more providers over a period of time, etc. Right? So, as a product, we are trying to, ensure that our boundary is fairly permissive. Mm-hmm. And along those lines, we are also making it modular. Right?
Okay.
So making sure that, as a product and as something that promises to cover the entire breadth of these operations, especially mm-hmm. for something like a startup, we are required to do like a lot of things, right? Mm-hmm. Starting from automatically generating CI configurations on top of CI and CD configurations on top of your provider automatically generating infrastructure from templates, Terraform templates that we provision, etc. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of larger organizations do not want this and do not need this, right? Because they have some kind of processes in place already.
Gotcha.
And maybe for new initiatives, they might refer to this kind of an option. Which is sort of baked out of the box. But, we do have the flexibility of just choosing a part of the entire stack to work with, which makes it much easier for adoption, right?
No, I think it makes sense, right? Like startups definitely need the most help because they don't have 5 or 10 years of platform engineering teams that have been around and built something internally that's custom and native to how things work inside that enterprise. Startups are definitely figuring things out, and with this modular architecture, again, they can start with a single cloud provider, they can start with Terraform, they can start with Argo CD and get up and running, and then, as you said, they can plug and play, like they can maybe switch things around if they wanted to try out a different infrastructure stack. So I think that the description makes sense, like where this tool is mainly focused towards startups. Enterprises can still use it if they're starting something new and want to use some of these newer cloud native technology stacks. So thank you. That makes sense.
Yeah. And you know, something that we do see people using us for is the onboarding onto Kubernetes, right? When you know, when you don't have something to begin with, and then you're starting off on that journey for one particular product area or one particular environment as a pilot or whatever, right?
Yep.
And that's sort of where we make things very easy by essentially being an IDP, which also does things, right? Like, it's not just a view layer, but it's also an action layer. So it's a mix of those two that that we bring to the table.
Got it. Now, you know, you mentioned onboarding onto Kubernetes as being sort of one of the main use cases. What are some other ones? I mean, I know like bootstrapping, you know, startups or small companies. Do you see people using this type of tool in a specific way? Like, you know, say they're new to cloud deployments and they want to get started on GCP. Like, give me a little bit more about the use cases.
Right. So if you look at how the landscape looks like today, right? Let's look at like the smallest of startups, which we are just starting off. You have maybe like a front end repo, a back end repo, maybe just one repo for both, right? And one service for both, more importantly. When you have something like that, pretty much everything becomes overkill if you're even if you're just looking to deploy to something like you know, an ECS or something. It starts becoming more hassle than actually just getting that first line of code out there, right? So it's a very weird problem, because the way the landscape looks like, there is something that is really well suited for the smaller teams, smaller like lesser complexity, and then there's something else that works entirely for a different spectrum, place in the spectrum, right? So when folks are starting off, you usually have something like an some kind of an app runner, right? Like a Heroku or something like that. People start off on that, and then eventually there are additional requirements that come in, like storage buckets and queues and like managed services around Kafka, etc. Right?
Yeah.
So when all of these start piling in, that is when, you know, folks realize, hey, okay, we probably should move to a full cloud or something like that. In some cases, people start off with something like a Beanstalk or just a container runner, and then realize that you know, they have workload limitations, they have capacity limitations, etc., and they are looking for a more fully fledged kind of solution. So that's actually one very very common use case that we see, where folks are just migrating onto, you know, the most powerful substrate that you can sort of get to, which is Kubernetes, right? And in many cases, it's also not necessary, not explicitly, hey, like, we want to get to Kubernetes. It's like Argonaut sort of solves that you know, ceiling limitation, while also providing a fairly flexible and easy to use you know, interface.
I think that's one. Go ahead.
Sorry. The second one is actually a little more interesting, and this is not something that we had designed for, but you know, it's funny to see people use it this way. Startups
they'll always use it differently than you design.
So since we also provide this kind of a cloud abstraction layer, right? Companies essentially in their first couple of years use AWS or something, or GCP, use their credits, and then eventually they're like, okay, we are getting another $100,000 for free, let's just switch, right? And given that Argonaut sort of normalizes that layer, it makes it very easy, and we saw a bunch of customers doing this, which was very interesting to note, but not something that we had foreseen when we had started building this out.
Is this from, so you're talking about using multiple clouds in this case, because you're sort of a layer on top?
Yes and no. So it's not really multiple clouds at the same time, but essentially shifting from one cloud to another cloud.
So making it easier because it's the common layers on top of.
Right. Well, you could use it in any way. Like the product doesn't really limit you, but that's what we saw people doing primarily.
This is an unknown use case.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel like this is a like that use case is something we talked about when cloud first came out. Is like cloud enables you to do these kind of things, but then the reality was, you got locked into a cloud because of all the specific tooling, right? So maybe this is sort of a we're seeing kind of a realization of how to do these kind of things.
it's interesting, but yeah.
Gotcha. So I know you said the one keyword, and I'm surprised that Ryan didn't pick it up. Like you said, people are using Heroku, and I also saw...
I always talk about Heroku.
Yeah.
Because I used it in the past, and I really enjoyed it, but it definitely was, it's like, the commonalities and the parts that are missing are quite interesting to where we're at now.
Yeah. And on your documentation, Surya, you have a section dedicated to how users can move away or migrate from Heroku onto Kubernetes. Is that happening? Is that like, are people like Ryan who have used Heroku in the past now thinking about Kubernetes, and how are we helping them?
Yeah, so that actually is happening a little bit.
Cool.
Primarily because of what Heroku is doing to itself, rather than explicitly what we are doing to pull. We're just making it easy for people who are looking for alternatives, right? Heroku, while it has like an amazing developer experience, sort of can't be beat, right? Like, because when you have complete control over everything from the runtime to the user experience layer in terms of what workloads you can build on top of it, mm-hmm. etc., mm-hmm. And all the ways in which you can interface with it, as opposed to explicitly taking a delineation on hey, like we will be working modularly with Kubernetes and platform ABC, whatever, right? There is a more integrated experience that you can provide, and mm-hmm. Heroku does a great job. And app runners are great for that reason. And one of the reasons why smaller teams also start off on that, right? That's definitely there. So in terms of what we do to make that easy, we support the same build packs that Heroku does. So you can, you don't even have to worry about containerization. As step one, it's not a blocker really, right? And then we are sort of limited by the half an hour that AWS and GCP take to spin up Kubernetes clusters. But apart from that, it's almost as simple as what you would do with Heroku, where you essentially push to deploy. On the plus side, we do have like a lot more flexibility, especially when given that we have the full power of things like ingress controllers and API mm-hmm. gateways, etc., right? There are some weird use cases where you need specific certificates to be used because of certain requirements, business case requirements, etc., and all of those kind of things are much easier to do when you're dealing with something like Argonaut.
Okay, makes sense. And I think Ryan found this out when he was going through your documentation, where you say teams or organizations don't realize that they are spending 30% of their time on infrastructure wrangling. Again, to me personally, that feels like a lower bar, a low percentage. I've seen around the 70% mark where, again, this number doesn't apply to like just the new stack, right? The Kubernetes way of doing things, but traditional infrastructure admins as well, where 70% or more than their time was gone on just keeping the lights on, making sure that the infrastructure is up and running. Like with this new way of doing things with Kubernetes, with all the cloud native technology, where do you think this lost time is? And like, what does this actually mean? How can we give them the time back? And can you expand a bit more on that?
Right. So I can talk about it in like a two ways, right? Yeah. One is what the workflow looks like and where the time is going in. And the second is like, what can we do about it, right? So if you look at where the time goes, so things like setting up and managing environments, they take time, especially the stable environments. And then, if you want to build out tooling which enables things like preview environments or like spinning up environments mm-hmm. on demand, that's a whole another ball game, right? Mm-hmm. Because you require overlays, you require specific, specific things to be fixed and specific things to be configurable. And domain names, et cetera, like DNSs, et cetera, are always going to be a little yep. bit of a pain, right? So, just setting up this kind of stack is a multi-month, if not a multi-year effort for like a team, right?
Yeah.
And then, so there's just one part of it. Getting visibility into deployments and especially cost visibility is sort of not a thing at this point, right? Like it's, we're just, as an industry, just starting off on that journey where we have like really good cost visibility into and attribution into like where specific cloud dollars are being spent.
Yep.
Right? You know, even today, for instance, it's very hard to get a handle on egress costs, ingress costs, like bandwidth, bandwidth related stuff on even the major clouds.
Gotcha.
And then debugging is another piece that, it's a bit of a mess, but, it's also fairly templated in an organization. So in the sense that every organization has like a bunch of a specific type of failure modes or a specific set of failure modes, and you go through that checklist and you're not usually okay.
Gotcha.
But you know, discovering that and putting that together is going to be a bit of a challenge. And then maintenance is like a biggie which sort of sneaks up on you, right? And this is what I see most people not accounting for on day one, which is you know, Kubernetes versions keep getting deprecated like every year and a half. And then with that, API changes, et cetera, come in. Your application stacks, all the tool sets that you depend on, right? Starting from ingress controllers to certificate management to everything else. All of those require continuous upgrades to essentially be secure and, you know, for teams to leverage the best and greatest, that again takes a significant amount of time. So what we try to do is essentially understand all of these and put in mechanisms to for instance automate a lot of these processes out, right? For instance, when it comes to Kubernetes cluster version upgrades, we have mechanisms to detect what APIs are, if any deprecated APIs are being used and by what tools, figure out an upgrade path for them, and then automatically manage the cluster upgrades as well, right? Sort of possible easily because we don't just provide a view layer, but we also control the workloads on top to an extent. Those kind of things are, capabilities that we deliver on from day one, which sort of makes teams a lot more efficient.
Okay, gotcha. So Argonaut is basically allowing these admins or DevOps admins to not just automate day zero operations, but also help them simplify some of the day two operations, like debugging and monitoring with their observability and visibility stack. So, okay, that makes sense, like being that platform, right? It's helping day zero and day two operations. But I wanted to know about the tech stack itself. Like, I know, like, we love Kubernetes on this podcast. It's Kubernetes Bytes. But rarely do organizations have just one infrastructure or application stack, right? They might have a combination of apps running on EC2 instances. Maybe they have modernized some applications to be serverless even. Can Argonaut help me orchestrate Lambda functions, for example, just using this IDP, or is it just restricted to Kubernetes?
Right. We do not deal with direct virtual machines.
Okay.
But we do deal with Lambdas and Kubernetes as the substrates that we support at this point.
Gotcha. Right?
We've been toying around with, providing a Knative, for instance, as a first-class citizen.
Nice.
Where, it's still on Kubernetes, but it's also a little bit of a different beast, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The kind of interactions that developers would have with a Knative enabled Kubernetes cluster is going to be slightly different, right? So we are going to be adding these over time, but at this point, until we sort of saturate this out, we're probably going to stick with Lambdas plus Kubernetes as
well. You have so many employees, I don't know why you just keep
keep we want more, come on.
Depends. So we're definitely open to all of these enhancements. And, you know, we've thought about it. We've talked about it internally. It's just a matter of like sequencing this out.
Yep.
In terms of value and impact.
Yeah, gotcha. Absolutely. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about sort of what happens when you see teams sort of tackle things on their own. A little bit about anti-patterns, and I know we kind of talked about this in our intro call a little bit. You know, what are some of the things that you find you know, these DevOps teams or teams putting together these pipelines themselves create sort of poor practices or anti-patterns that you see in sort of that ad hoc approach where, you know, someone with somewhat of a skill set or a really good skill set over here kind of put everything together? What does that look like?
So, the thing with the anti-patterns, the most common anti-patterns is that these are enabled because they're just the easiest way to do things. And okay. In some cases, it's not the wrong thing to do.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. On day one, you don't want to be set like when before you write your first line of code, you don't really want to be setting up like a very vast Terraform script with like Kubernetes up and all of that, right?
Yeah.
You first want to get to, you know, an MVP and product market fit before you start looking deeper into like tightening these nuts and bolts. So there are usually very good reasons for mm-hmm. this, and the reasons also tend to be a path of like history kind of thing, right? Where it's the evolution what is right at each local mm-hmm. Phase in the evolution of the company might not necessarily be optimal if you just look back, right?
Yep.
So it's easy to call them out as anti-patterns, but to be fair, there's usually a reason why that happens. That said, that's something that we try to tackle and we try to ease for our customers because we try to get the the end state, but with the ease of not having to worry about the path related dependencies. Right?
Would you say that it's more of like a, you know, teams start off on a path to get something out the door to test the, you know, kick the tire, so to speak, and then it's harder to backpedal out of that once they've kind of developed a way of doing things, right?
And I know exactly.
We've seen this in sort of security practices too, where security is always like, well, just get me the RBAC and everything else that just makes my thing work, but they put less thought into it, and then they have to figure it out afterwards. Is it similar to that?
Exactly. So it even starts more basic than that, right? Like a bunch of prospects. I have conversations where, you know, the current deployment practice is essentially for like a team of like 20 to 50 engineers to actually just go to an EC2 instance, do a git pull, and do an npm start or something like that, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And it works, and it works until it doesn't. Right. it stops working when, you know, you have like a lot of people trying to do this in parallel, multiple that's sort of when it starts breaking down, at which point it's also a little difficult to move out of because when you're used to this kind of a model, you, because of the flexibility it affords, you also start looking at, hey, here are some shared files between my front end and back end for, let's say, some interfaces or some API signatures or whatever. Yeah. And because that is enabled, there's some kind of auxiliary coupling that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So moving out and containerizing it actually becomes an effort, right?
Sure.
So this is something that I've seen like multiple times over, especially when working with like startups, etc. Right? It's definitely faster than faster on day, like when you're getting started, than containerizing and getting and moving with it. But you sort of pay the price down the line, right? And then the other anti-pattern is when teams internally realize that this is happening, and then they sort of dial 11 on the other side, right? And sort of build overly complex architectures, which is more of an emulation of what like internet scale companies require rather than what is required for them for the next few years, right? And potentially that is again a fairly costly affair because of things like introducing service meshes when you have like 5 to 10 services, mm-hmm. right? It's both an overhead in terms of management and in also in terms of like, you know, the net costs that you'll end up having to pay for the same effective resource utilization.
Got it.
Right? So yeah. That's a second kind of thing that we notice. And, you know, as a part of our interactions with, you know, with companies, we also try to talk to them about what the pros and cons of what they're trying to do is. Potentially suggest the right kind of approach given an understanding of their requirements. So it's a little bit of a consultative thing as well if the customers choose to do that, so that, you know, we can provide our perspective and then, you know, they can figure out what they want to do.
Got it. Makes sense. So really it's like, you know, process in terms of certain situation can lead to like some practices that are hard to pull out of. Another part of it is inefficiencies, which sort of lead to, you know, have a direct impact on cost and kind of how things are handled there. And thirdly, it's just a matter of like planning and communication. I feel like, you know, that's probably quite common in a lot of teams. I know I've been part of teams just like that, especially earlier on, but it's good to see these kind of things, you know, are sort of known now, at least, hopefully better known now.
Yeah. Excellent summary. You're damn good at this. The fact that we shine a light on a lot of these is actually the step one to resolving this, right?
Okay. Yeah,
and as an industry, I think we're getting to a good place there. We also have a little ways to go, and
yeah,
it's always
that's
evolving.
Fair.
Okay. So moving on, right? I know when we spoke last time, we spoke about Dagger.io, and I didn't know about Dagger.io and the thing existed. Can you talk more about what it is and how does Argonaut use it to actually help solve some of the CI challenges for customers?
Right. So Dagger.io is an amazing project, specifically because it works as a CI abstraction layer, mm-hmm. right? A CI agnostic layer where you can define your workflows. You can define your CI workflows without being tied to a CI provider.
Okay.
So it's great that way, and you write it in code, right?
Okay.
There are like a bunch of SDKs available for it. We are internally predominantly Golang, so we use the Golang SDK for it. It's great because you can write once and sort of deploy it anywhere. Now, there are two benefits. One for teams that are generally adopting it, where mm-hmm. you can essentially do the same thing, run the same thing on your local as you would run on, let's say, something like GitHub Actions or GitLab or mm-hmm. Jenkins or whatever. And there is that translation, right? Which makes it easier for testing and for like faster iterations. Now, that's great. Now, for us, it adds another level of value because we can write that logic once for our mm-hmm. customers mm-hmm. and sort of have it available on multiple CI providers. So we don't have to replicate our logic. We don't have to replicate and maintain differences and so on, right? So that makes it super easy.
Gotcha. Nice.
It also enables for us things like a drag and drop UI builder for CI, where you can sure. just drag a few nodes and, you know, connect them together, etc. So things like that, because we can internally generate that as code and pass it on.
Okay. Does it allow the teams to use the CI tool directly once Dagger.io is used, or do they have to kind of use Dagger.io afterwards, or is it just the abstraction that helps you kind of deploy different ones? So, I'm unfamiliar with the tool. I love it, by the way. I think I learned it talking to you last time. It's very cool.
Right. By the way, this is by the same folks who started Docker. So it's
okay.
Essentially containerization, standardization, but for nice. CIs, right? Like, I think that philosophy is
definitely
visible.
Abstractions.
I forget who it was. There is no someone who said there is no problem in computer science that cannot be solved with another level of interaction.
yeah, I've heard that one.
So to answer your question, you would be reliant on the Dagger.io SDKs, because you're essentially defining all your logic as not YAMLs that are specific to GitHub Action language or GitLab CI language or what have you. But you're essentially writing them in Golang, and you are using the Dagger.io primitives and the SDK to do it, right?
And so the end user, like a customer in your case, would have to also do that.
We actually do that for our customers.
Okay, got it.
And we enable like drag and drop UI builders and stuff like that to make it easier for them. But they can choose to do that as well. The integration point is essentially like a stub that you would be plugging into your GitHub workflows so that it actually runs. Right. That's about it.
Okay. Makes sense. Well, we do want to give you the opportunity to let people know where they can find out more and stuff like that. But before we do that, we have a small part of our show that we basically asked ChatGPT to come up with a question about the topic that we're talking about with our guest, which is you today. And we asked it to come up with a question about sort of a DevOps and automation environments. And it said, given the complexities of managing multiple cloud environments, if you were to compare DevOps in a multi-cloud environment to a roller coaster ride, what would be the most thrilling, the most terrifying, and the most unexpected parts of the ride? So you can answer it, or we also let ChatGPT answer it itself, if you prefer.
I'll take a stab at it, but I'd be curious to understand what ChatGPT says as well. The most terrifying thing is almost certainly network costs.
Okay. Okay.
When you're dealing with inter cloud communication, etc.
Okay.
Sometimes even inter-availability zone and inter-region costs can skyrocket.
There you go.
And that kind of problem only compounds with multi-cloud scenarios. It's very important that you design for these from day one properly.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
The thrilling part is to actually be able to leverage the best of multiple clouds. Specifically, for instance, Azure has a managed OpenAI service, which is great, and it's from what I hear, it's more performant than the OpenAI offering directly consumers would directly get, right? So the ability to mix and match something like that with something like BigQuery, which is again unique and amazing in its own right. And potentially like the stability of some of the services that you get from AWS, right?
Okay.
So having the ability to mix and match these kind of things is amazing. And so long as you're okay with the, the side effects that come in.
As long as you make it back to the starting point after your roller coaster ride, I think everything is good.
Yeah, you don't want to fall off a cliff.
Yep.
that would be the most exciting and the most
unexpected,
terrifying parts of that ride.
I think you nailed a couple that it actually came out with. I mean, so in terms of expenses and cost, it actually said that was the unexpected part of the ride. Basically, hidden costs and performance issues, surging and twists and turns in the roller coaster, kind of compared that to that. The terrifying part, it said, is security and compliance. It said, it's like the sudden drop in the roller coaster.
Right.
Each year application secure across all the platforms. And then the thrilling part, it actually talked about initial setup and deployment, right? The exciting sort of climb to the top that it said. So I think you hit on a couple of things that it also hit on, which is, that's just good. So,
but I have a question. Like, if it's unexpected, the costs are always categorized as unexpected. At what point can we say that they are expected?
Well, you know that the costs are unexpected because you don't know the magnitude of it, but they're going to be there.
Yep.
You don't know if it's going to be $1,000 or like a million.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're like, didn't know how steep that drop actually was.
Yep.
Cool. Well, Surya, if you have anywhere you would like to send someone to find out more information, where they can find you, interact with a community you might have, or docs, this is the time to spit it all out. And then we'll put them in the show notes as well.
Oh, amazing. Our product is free for anyone to sign up and try out. And we have a basic free tier as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you can access that on our website, argonaut.dev. That's argonaut.dev. And, I'm available on Twitter and LinkedIn, and my handle is my first name followed by last name, which is Surya Oruganti. I'd be happy to connect with anyone and give them a tour of the roller coaster ride.
That's awesome, man. And again, just to recap, highlight, right? I think yesterday you shared on LinkedIn that Argonaut made all the way to number one on the Hacker News list. So kudos. And hopefully, like, we keep pushing that boundary.
Thank you so much. And yeah, can't make it happen without the love of all our customers.
Absolutely. Awesome. And Surya, thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
It's great being here. Thank you for having me.
All right, Bhavan, that was a fun conversation with Surya. I think this is sort of the second episode we've done in a row sort of on this type of technology, yeah. Which I actually like that we did it that way. We kind of got to see kind of the different approaches and mm-hmm. sort of more or less, I was more interested in see like, why did they create these companies, right? Yeah. Why is this problem being solved and, you know, a challenge for other folks? And I think for me, it's really just like that need, of the abstraction, right? Things mm-hmm. are getting quite complex. There's a lot of layers. If you were to roll your own Kubernetes or even use sort of a cloud-based sort of managed offering, you still have to kind of tack on a lot of things to make it, you know, quote unquote, production ready or something yeah. you'd want to keep that full, you know, cycle of development and releasing and all that stuff. There's a lot of things you got to tack on, whether it's like service meshes or GitOps platforms or, you know, security components or whatever it may be. There's a lot going on. So I definitely see how this tool is intensely useful when you're starting out, right? I think it's yeah. definitely, for me, you know, coming from a larger company, I think it'd be more challenging maybe to kind of weave it in. But I think both of these scenarios, it sounds like a lot of this can be a little bit flexible. So the abstraction mm-hmm. kind of over top of those managed offerings or even your sort of, you know, wherever you want to set things up, that's I think yep. key to enable kind of the full workflow wherever you want to get going. I don't know what you thought about it.
No, I think I agree with you on the first point, right? Like it was great that we had Kube first and Argonaut back-to-back episodes that talks about the theme that Kubernetes is de facto standard, Kubernetes has crossed the chasm, all those buzzwords. But we are moving towards a point where Kubernetes is boring and even the startup ecosystem is figuring out or thinking about what else we should be solving. And this is a definite pain point for new organizations or new startups that are just starting up and building their applications on the cloud native stack. So if I'm a two-person company, should I spend 3 months just figuring out all the different open source projects and build something? Or should I just use something like an Argonaut IDP or a Kube first deployment and deploy something and just start working on my application?
Yeah, unless you find pleasure from that pain or something like yeah. that. You go and you want to go through all that.
Yeah, but it's not your company. So even if you find pleasure, don't work on it. Come on, guys. We can be better. But even for larger organizations, right? I remember when I used to work for a previous employer, it wasn't called an IDP, but they had a system where users can go and request for virtual machines, which basically deployed things on their backend VMware and OpenStack infrastructures.
Yeah.
And I left before they modernized into delivering Kubernetes clusters. So I think at that point when I was leaving, it was in a process where the developers were still requesting for virtual machines and deploying their own Kubernetes clusters.
Yeah.
I'm sure that like there are organizations that move slowly and they haven't gotten to a point where they're deploying all of these things for a developer. Like they're not deploying a multi-tenant solution with GitOps and with different sure. components installed. I think if you are a team that's on that bleeding edge, want to adopt these new technologies, even if you are inside a big organization, maybe these kinds of tools can help you get started faster and yeah. prove your value, like value of the work that you're doing faster. Maybe you get more investments based on that. So I think I like the approach where these vendors are going or where these the past few guests are going, where let's just make things really easy for developers and see where it goes. So I'm excited. I also like the fact that there are startups that are using the cloud credits from different vendors intelligently. So like maybe they can get started on AWS yeah. and then they realize that, Microsoft just gave me $100,000. Why not take my entire tech stack and move it somewhere else. So
there's no easy feat, right? So I feel like you need something kind of like either build something like this or, you know, take advantage of a
tool. I think that's taking us back to your point about abstractions, right? If you have an abstraction, the infrastructure layer becomes plug and play, like
it always comes back to abstractions. You know, at the end of the day, any technology problems, you're just gonna find out it's just an abstraction later on. I mean, we've talked about this, you know, months and months ago, that, you know, that problem of Kubernetes, the landscape being very complex, even too complex for scenarios where, you know, the answer is don't use Kubernetes. And I've actually seen a lot more of that come out lately, and people are realizing that don't use Kubernetes is a very realistic option that people should do, right? Because you can go down a very big rabbit hole unless you're kind of taking on sort of building the platform and, you know, anyway, using something like this. I feel like there's a couple different routes that the community has taken, which is like, just don't use it, or, you know, solve the complexity with a tool that'll build all the pieces, right? Or at least get you 80% of the way there. I think that's kind of the way I feel about these tools, is it'll probably get you most of the way there. But every organization is going to be slightly different, you know, one or two.
Yeah, as we all know, right? Like the last mile is the most difficult part of any delivery or any application delivery, I guess, for that matter. So these tools can get you that 80%, 90% there, but you'll still have to customize things. But it's better to start at that 80% mark or that 90% mark. If somebody tells me to run a marathon, if they're dropping me at the 23rd mile, I'm like, yeah, let's do
Is that an option? Can I do that?
Let's start a startup that does that, right?
Run a marathon.
We give everybody beer for the first 23 miles, and then the last 3 miles or whatever's remaining, they can just manage on their own.
That's two kinds of marathons in one, I think. Awesome. Well, anyway, fun episode, and we have a bunch more fun ones coming up in the future, but I think that closes it out for this episode. Thank you for listening, and that brings us to the end of today's episode. My name's Ryan.
I'm Bhavin.
Thanks for joining another episode of Kubernetes Bytes.
Thank you for listening to the Kubernetes Bytes podcast.